My name's Sarah George, and I'm the Executive Director of the Utah Museum of Natural History, and I want to thank you all for joining us tonight at the Salt Lake City Main Library Auditorium. We'd also like to welcome those of you who are listening on KCPW Public Radio, 88.3 and 105.3 FM. This is the fifth year of The Nature of Things. We've been delighted to present biologist Ed Wilson, journalist Michael Pollan, global commentator Thomas Friedman, and public activist Robert Kennedy Jr., along with many scientists, writers, and public policy makers over the last few years. This year, our theme is Reinventing Energy, and our speakers will be keynote Fred Krupp, who's president of the Environmental Defense Fund on March 2nd. He's also the author of a wonderful book called Earth, the Sequel. The Nature Conservancy's global scientist, John Huckstra, will be here in Salt Lake on March 16th. He will also be speaking in Moab at the Ground County Library on March 15th. And we'll have a community panel discussion called Utah's Clean Energy Frontline on April 6th. But it all begins with tonight's lecturer, Jeff Moose, from the Energy Dynamics Lab at Utah State University in Logan, Utah. I want to take a moment to acknowledge the support of our sponsors and partners. The Nature of Things is underwritten by a generous gift from the R. Harold Burton Foundation, and their support enables us to offer events like these tonight at, free or at very low cost to the community. I also want to thank our media partner, KCPW 88.3 FM, for getting the word out and for broadcasting. This lecture will also be available as a podcast on the museum's website after this evening. Additionally, we also want to acknowledge our other partners, Rio Tinto Kennecott Utah Copper, the Nature Conservancy, the Castle Foundation, the Leonardo, and USTAR for their valuable support. We couldn't do this without them, and we're very grateful. So now, our speaker tonight is Jeff Moose. He is the director of the Utah State University Energy Dynamics Laboratory, and he leads the laboratory's efforts in energy efficiency and renewable energy research and development. Moose came to Utah State in 2007 as a USTAR research professor, where he works with faculty colleagues to launch and grow the school's biofuels center. Prior to joining Utah State, he was at the Oak Ridge National Lab, where he was named Engineer Scientist of the Year and Science Communicator of the Year. Moose has over a dozen patents to his credit and has served as an energy and science policy advisor to the United States Senate. For decades, America's energy research and development establishment has favored incremental progress over transformational change. But Jeff argues that incremental change will not free us from our energy dilemma. Drawing on his 20-plus years of research experience, Moose will explain why America's energy innovation engine is largely stalled and how to get it running again. He'll describe his laboratory's role in nurturing risky, transformational, clean energy technologies, and describe some of the lab's research with game-changing potential for our energy and economic future. So please join me in welcoming Jeff Moose.
Thank you very much for that warm introduction, and welcome all of you for coming tonight, and I also want to welcome those who are listening on the radio. I must say that I wasn't too nervous until I heard the names of some of the speakers that you've had in the past, Thomas Friedman, for example. Tonight, I'm going to talk about transforming America's energy future. As Sari mentioned, our energy innovation engine is largely stalled. It isn't running on all cylinders, and it's long overdue for a tune-up. Until we change the oil and put in some new spark plugs, this sputtering energy innovation engine and our trajectory as a nation when it comes to energy use production will not change appreciably. We will continue to import 2/3 of the oil that we need. In 2008, that translated into a $475 billion wealth transfer to other nations. That's the equivalent to a couple thousand dollars per household. We will continue to see economy-damaging energy price spikes. For example, in 2008, we saw $4 gas. Like our grandparents, who stood outside and watched Sputnik shoot across the sky and realized that we were in competition with India and China, we stood at the gas pumps and watched gas prices shoot a hole in our pocketbook. And we began to realize that we were in competition with new competitors like China and India, who, according to a Federal Reserve report that came just after the mortgage meltdown and Wall Street meltdown, I should say, and the mortgage crisis, that these things were intertwined and were largely due, or partially at least due, to China and India's quest and thirst for more and more energy. We will also continue to see air quality problems. We don't have to look too far here in Salt Lake and Logan, where I live. Last month, Logan was home to some of the very worst air quality in the nation, largely due to the use of cars driving back and forth in the valley. And we will continue falling behind other nations when it comes to energy innovation. Foreign suppliers beat U.S. car manufacturers to the punch with hybrid cars about a decade ago. And recently, a number of studies, including one from the National Academies, pointed out that when it comes to things like new batteries for cars, solar cells, light-emitting diodes used for lighting systems, again, the United States is beginning to fall behind. The good news is that it's not too late. The U.S. continues to dominate the world stage in a number of areas: investment capital, risk-taking in other sectors of our economy. And most other nations have followed us down the pathway of incrementalism, fortunately for us. That is, doing things like, again, building better batteries, components where we know the existing needs. But it turns out that with the right mix of reforms in the federal energy R&D procurement process, for example, to improve competition, a new emphasis on research, universities, and small businesses, and a new focus on enabling, or what I would call, disruptive or transformational technologies and energy systems, we can regain U.S. prominence. We can leapfrog these competitors. We can solve these seemingly intractable energy problems. And we can train a new generation of innovators here at home in the United States. To do this, however, more people like you need to be engaged. If bloggers and Facebook junkies can topple a 30-year regime in Egypt in less than 3 weeks, surely we can work together to change and tune up the federal energy R&D engine and the R&D engine in general at the national level, so that it's running on all cylinders and better serving the needs of states like Utah, a state that's relatively underserved by today's federal energy R&D innovation engine, and the only state in the union that has recognizable supplies of wind, solar, third generation biomass, which I'll talk a little bit more about, geothermal, uranium, unconventional and several unconventional fossil resources. I'd like to, I asked the question last week, who will be coming to this lecture? And the answer that I received from Lisa was that we would have some curious adults. They'd come, just to quote her, it says, "Adults who are concerned about our energy future, looking for new perspectives and new understanding about this complex issue." You've already demonstrated a willingness to engage. You're here tonight, and I really appreciate that. This is an important issue that I'm very passionate about, and I'm eager to speak on it when I get a chance. Often when I talk to people on ski lifts or on airplane, and I tell them what I do, they at first express their concern, and then they say, what are you going to do about it? How are we going to fix these problems? And I'm guessing that so most of you are aware so what I want to do is talk about the need that we have, the realignments that need to be made, investments that need to be made, and I would also say that Utah is very well positioned as well. Over the past quarter century, I've had a good fortune of working in a number of environments. I worked in a small business where I learned that the profit needs geared activities towards near-term research. I worked at a large federal national laboratory where I learned that there are some gatekeepers who control access to program managers and perpetuate the status quo. They're considered experts in their field, but are sometimes blinded by the institutional and intellectual self-interests that often protect turf and thwart innovation often by outsiders. On Capitol Hill, I learned that politicians are relying on people like me to innovate our way out of this energy problem that we have. Innovation requires ideas, and my former boss, Lamar Alexander, who's a U.S. Senator from Tennessee, often told me that we have plenty, and I quote, we have plenty of tacticians here in Washington to implement things. What we really lack are good ideas. Over 3 years ago, I uprooted my family and I moved to Utah to pursue a few ideas that I thought and still believe are transformational. First embedded in the academic world, I learned that there is a need for an important focus on basic research and knowledge discovery within the academic institution. More recently, I moved into the Research Foundation, which is a little bit more applied, a little bit more aligned with my background, and has allowed me to advance or move some of these transformational energy systems forward. So my goal, again, is to share insights, describe some of EDL's projects, and talk about, have a few predictions and some next steps. I would first state, though, that my conclusion from all these experiences that I had is that there's no perfect place for energy innovation, but my journey has led me to some deep-rooted convictions on the topic that compel me to speak. And that's a long way of saying thank you for letting me come here tonight. I've already mentioned the challenges in the physical world that we face. Foreign oil addiction, wealth transfer to other nations, economy damage and energy price spikes, and polluted air as one of many environmental residuals of that. We also have a federal energy business model that's outdated, and I'm going to speak about that a little bit more in a second. We also lack quantifiable national energy goals. Our energy system is largely a private enterprise. The federal government provides incentives, loan guarantees, and the like. But in all the presidents in my lifetime or in recent memory have set, and unfortunately we've missed, a number of energy goals, national energy goals, dating back to President Carter, for example. When the presidents set goals that are actionable by the federal government, they can be met. For example, building interstate highways, going to the moon, building the atomic bomb. Those were all examples where we had a goal that was actionable by the president and the federal government directly. Since our energy systems is a largely private enterprise, it's a little bit more difficult to set a goal and keep it. Each of these activities that I mentioned took bold action on the part of the president, and they mobilized the nation around a common goal. There may be a few opportunities to do the same in the energy sector, and I will discuss at least one of those a little bit later. Another of our challenges is our prosperity is closely tied to the desire for individual flexibility, freedom, control, and choice. We all like to have our freedoms. We want to be able to get in our car and go from point A to B, point B without having to get out and get into a train. We want to go into a room and have the lights on and it warm in the wintertime and cool in the summer. So I think when we look at new solutions to our energy problems, we can't ignore that need that we have, or at least that the average American has. If you look at the president's emphasis in his 2012 budget, there are a couple bright spots. One of them is enhancing education, and the other is bringing wireless internet access to all Americans. Those are examples of flexibility, freedom, and choice, particularly the wireless internet access. Regarding some of his other emphasis, for example, high-speed rail and rebuilding existing infrastructure, such as highway and bridges, to stimulate growth, I'm a little bit more concerned. Americans have yet to demonstrate a willingness to give up the freedom, control, and choice that I've mentioned before, door-to-door transit, etc. And so as we move forward, we do need to look for ways to do that. I'd now like to back up and talk about the federal energy R&D ecosystem, if you want to call it that. It depends heavily on large government-owned laboratories. There are 16 of these laboratories. On this particular slide, you can see where some of them are located at. This was an organized for a actionable activity by the federal government, building the bomb. A worthy cause, a needed cause, at least in the recollection of most people. These laboratories over time have evolved and now garner a very large sum of money, roughly a fifth of the DOE budget, for example. Turns out that with that, there are a number of consequences. Let me back up for a second. Some of these labs are actually partially isolated from the population centers because of the atomic mission. And again, some of the unintended consequences of setting up the laboratory system was there has been some mission creep. For example, each of the offices has formal affiliation. Each of the laboratories have formal affiliation with a different office, but often do a lot of work for others. The laboratories are somewhat expensive and have a large research infrastructure. It's often difficult to get details on this topic, but the price tag for a researcher in the government is widely known to exceed by a noticeable margin those in university and industry. A quick look at the ARRA funding also would show that the national laboratories received a large percentage of the ARRA funds, several billions of dollars, again, to create new research infrastructure within the federal government. I'm curious if these investments would have been made in research universities and industry, how that might have changed things. Places like the USU and others. There's also a very well-established non-competitive procurement process that exists. These laboratories are written into the DOE budget each year. In effect, the department is earmarking its own budget because it's convenient, politically correct, and satisfies internal legacy performers and commitments that have evolved over the past half century. The government lab gatekeepers have insider access to program managers at the Department of Energy. They're badged, they can be badged into headquarters. They're free to roam the halls without being escorted and to gather intelligence on programs and so forth. Research and industry don't have that same privilege. An example of this, and if you don't mind me indulging for a few minutes in the process, I'll quickly get to the research at hand, is the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. 13 labs show up on the office's FY12 budget request, although only one, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, has formal office affiliation. The other labs, the other 12 labs, who they report to other offices, Office of Science, Nuclear Energy, Fossil Energy, Environmental Management. And those laboratories do around $400 million of work for that particular office. All told, roughly half the budget never leaves the federal government. And in total, the labs receive about $700 million from this office. That's an order of magnitude more than research universities have traditionally received through earmarks. Although there are 14 university-affiliated research centers, or something called a UARC, affiliated with other agencies, none are affiliated with the Department of Energy, this office, or any other. So as the system ages, it becomes more and more risk-averse. So what I'd like to do now is turn to a few slides or a short discussion on transformation and where it can occur. In this particular slide, we're showing an example of an energy system, building energy systems, and there are subsystems, for example, building envelopes, lighting systems, HVAC systems. And within those, there are a number of components. In the case of lighting, there's ballasts, lamps, and luminaires, or light fixtures. And then, from there, there's one more layer down you can go on innovation at the material or process level, looking at incandescent materials, light-emitting diodes, or fluorescent materials. So there are different levels where innovation can occur. They can occur at the very highest level, or they can occur at lower levels. I don't know if you can see this slide or not, but I have shown an example, a different example, where transformation can occur. They can occur at the material or process level, which is where most of our research now is headed. They can occur at the component level, subsystem level, and so forth. In this case, what I've shown is the classification of advanced battery research. At the vehicle transportation level, it's really an incremental. It has little bearing. We still have self-propelled vehicles, for example. If you go one layer down from sort of the surface transportation level to the self-propelled vehicle level, still relatively incremental. At the propulsion level or at the engine level, certainly it's translational or transformational. And where it truly is transformational is with onboard energy storage. So the question is, for example, do we have to store all of our energy on board a vehicle as we travel down the highway? Current paradigm says yes. New research says maybe not. But it turns out that risks are much higher with innovations that create changes at the higher level. For example, if you look at most of what the Department of Energy expends its resources on, and you look at the presidential initiatives that have been announced over the years, the focus has been on process and material level research, where the technical risk may be very, very high, but the social risks, the socio-scientific risk among researchers, political risk, organizational risk, personal risk, and programmatic risk are much lower. As you try to step up this system and look at things that might transform systems at a higher level, the risks go up dramatically. Here are several examples of known needs and requirements. We need more efficient light bulbs, more efficient solar cells. We need self-propelled cars requiring less or no oil. We need more drought-tolerant crops grown in less fertile soil to produce biofuels. Examples of R&D are shown here on this particular slide. They're the traditional things that we're working on today at the federal level, the university level, and so forth. Systems-level transformation requires us to look beyond today's known needs and requirements to create new paradigms and R&D market space. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency out of the Department of Defense, is known to look at these sorts of things. As a matter of fact, this particular slide's been sort of adapted from their one-pager on why they exist and what they do. Transformative energy systems usually don't fit into established silos, and I'll show you a few examples later. Is it an energy issue? Is it a transportation issue, for example? Is it something that fits into energy efficiency, or is it a renewable generation technology? There are examples that don't necessarily fit into the silos that we've created. Also, some of these transformational energy systems employ seemingly unrelated technologies. And I'll share a few of those a little later. Oftentimes, as I begin to look at this, they're very, very old ideas made possible by new developments. And almost always, without exception, they're promoted by outsiders who are less invested in the current paradigms, in the current research activities, than the insiders. So why does incrementalism flourish? Well, these transformational energy systems are very risky. They don't fit neatly. They require extra effort to move forward. It takes much more time and effort to sell them to the establishment. They also encroach on the territory of others, and they stray from the established R&D pathways. For example, a program manager at the Department of Energy hears the president talk about the need for better batteries. It's likely that he's going to fall in line and help. And I'm not saying we don't need better car batteries, but there may be some things we can look at beyond that. The existing process structures also reward compliance. These gatekeepers conform to rather than confront existing paradigms. And the financial risk to non-conformity to the insiders is too great. And oftentimes the researchers are forced, very creative researchers are forced to follow the money. At the Energy Dynamics Laboratory, our mission is to develop transformational energy systems and processes that provide step function improvements. As Sarah mentioned, I don't think incrementalism is enough. We have to think about this differently. Our two niches are transformational energy efficiency and renewable energy, and processes and systems that make the most of Utah's unique resources in an environmentally responsible way. We have five branches, or five sort of groups. Algae energy systems. I mentioned earlier that a traditional approach would be to look at how can we make regular crops grown in fertile soil more drought tolerant. We're working on a system that essentially moves the biomass production and cultivation from ground-based systems to aquatic-based systems. We're working on next-generation fossil energy activities. We have, and I'll show you some material related to activities in the Uinta Basin. Anytime that you develop new energy technologies, you have to baseline them with measurements. And so we have a group of individuals working on some environmental measurements, aerosols, air quality measurements, things of that nature. We're also looking at intuitive buildings. Again, looking beyond the light bulb at the lighting system. How can we make these systems adapt? And vehicle and roadway electrification. Many of you may not have heard of roadway electrification, but I'll explain that it may be possible to wirelessly power vehicles, both stationary and in motion, using a technology that was developed for something else. We have four locations in here in Utah. Most of our staff is located in Logan. We have individuals here in Salt Lake, in Park City, and out in Vernal, Utah. This slide is a very busy slide, and I apologize for that. and I hope you can read the words. It shows a few examples of an old and new paradigm and our research efforts. The first one is an intuitive lighting system, and the relevance of that is that lighting consumes about a fifth of all the electricity in the United States. The old paradigm is that lighting systems are binary. They're on and off, and they're designed for worst-case scenario needs. That is, an older person reading 10-point font in their office, for example. It turns out that most people don't need that much light. And even those individuals don't need that much light when they're working on their computer or talking to someone in their room. Not only do they not need it, but they don't even desire it. The new paradigm is in a dynamic system that adapts spatially and temporally based on the needs of the occupant. You're at your computer, you have certain lighting needs. You're reading, your needs change. Someone enters the room, the needs change again. The difficulty there is that virtually anybody, including the general public, can see some problems. Well, we don't want to have the lights flickering, coming on and off. So the system has to be anticipatory rather than reactive. It has to have lighting design built into it as it occurs so that it is essentially seamless to the occupant. The challenge there is not better materials for light bulbs, but it's real-time scene interpretation, task identification, and control. Today's gaming technologies can be applied to this application. The impact could be tremendous. We could cut our, if we went to this sort of a system, one study by the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute suggests that we could double our efficiency and cut our total electricity use by 10%. Their study was based on the idea of having task lights by office computers. It was also based on people being forced to turn them on and off manually. Getting back to the issue of flexibility, convenience, and control, we need to make these things so seamless to the occupants that they don't have to do anything. The second one is algae energy systems, and biofuels reduce, the relevance there is that biofuels reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And the old paradigm was terrestrial systems growing plants in areas with fertile land and rainfall. The new paradigm is an open aquatic algae cultivation system where land quality and rain are really non-issues. The R&D challenge is to, in this particular case, is to come up with ways to cleverly to grow the algae inexpensively, get rid of the dewater and dry, and improve the overall aerial yield and volumetric yield. The impact could be shifting the production of biofuels to non-ag areas, non-agricultural areas, and nix the competition between food and fuel and recycled carbon in the process, because the algae can use the carbon to produce biofuels more readily, faster. The next is an adaptive solar energy system. We know that solar is an abundant resource. It's largely untapped. The energy density of solar energy is relatively low, about 1,000 watts per square meter. So wouldn't it be nice, and let me back up and say that there's a report that was written by a group of 250 researchers who on the front page said that all routes for solar energy use required capture, conversion, and storage. I would argue that using sunlight in its natural form doesn't require conversion or storage. So the idea, or the new paradigm, is multifunctional systems that adapt and use the resource directly, piping sunlight at one time and generating electricity the next based on the needs of the occupant. The need there is optical switchyards that can spatially and temporally redirect sunlight based on the needs of the occupants in the buildings. At 1 minute, generating electricity if there's nobody in a room, and the next minute, piping the sunlight because it's more valuable to use the sunlight in its natural form than it is to convert it into electricity. The last one, and probably the most audacious, is wireless electric vehicles and electric highways. Vehicle transportation is our primary factor in our dependence on oil. It's the primary reason for energy price shocks, and it's also largely part of our air pollution problem. Self-propelled vehicles, the old paradigm is that self-propelled vehicles remain the convenient method of surface transport, and the only thing that we do is we switch fuels or storage mediums. A new paradigm would be that wireless electric vehicles can be charged stationary, for example, in your garage or in the parking lot of your favorite new supermarket, or even at work, without you having to plug them in, for example. And eventually, on highways. The idea there is we're not only switching fuels, but we're switching energy carriers from the vehicle being the energy carrier to the grid being the energy carrier. I would ask, which of those two do you think is the more efficient way to move energy from point A to point B? The grid or a 4,000-pound car carrying 50 pounds of fuel? So the challenge there is, can you efficiently and safely and in a low-cost manner wirelessly power vehicles on highways or even in parking lots? The impact could be that you could eliminate the range anxiety. You could radically cut our foreign oil use. We could go to electric transportation, and we could maintain that user flexibility and control that I talked about earlier. At EDL, we have eight pillars: people, purpose, passion, partnerships, patience, persistence, priority, and perseverance. And I'm not going to go through each one of these individually, but if one wants to convince the world to investigate wireless hybrids, it takes some time and effort. Here are a few people at the Energy Dynamics Lab. I have a few photos, a few pictures of folks here for those who are on the radio who are involved in those eight pillars. They are the people who have the passion. Karen Wolf handles all of our partnerships. She spends a lot of time on the phone with national lab partners, industry partners, etc. Hunter Wu is a 22-year-old PhD who started college when he was 15 and studied under the world's foremost expert on wireless power transfer. Kevin Shurtleff, some of you may know. Kevin is a longtime Utah resident who has very passionately taken up the algae calls in the last 12 months, the algae energy systems call. Arvind Dazu is an electrical engineer working on intuitive lighting systems, real-time scene interpretation, adaptive control. Paul Israelson is our deputy director, and he recently won the Governor's Medal of Science and Technology. I've also included Rob Buchanan, who's not an EDL employee. He's a vice president at USU, but if any of you get a chance to go out to Vernal and look at a new facility that was built there through a number of private donations, he has made a lot happen over the last 2 years. Scott Hill is working with him out in the basin at the Bingham Research Center. I wanted to share these individuals with you so that it was obvious that we have a team and we're working together. I want to talk a little bit more about this intuitive of three or four of these areas. Intuitive lighting, the opportunity there is the electric lights are the largest consumer of energy in commercial buildings. And prior R&D is all focused on lamps rather than systems. Lighting quality and quantity does not adapt to the needs of the occupants in current systems. A lot of light is wasted in unoccupied space and beyond the needs of the occupants. There's no control spatially, temporally, or even in the future, chromatically. The systems are binary. The approach is to create these sensors that are embedded in the roof, or I should say the ceiling of rooms, and they adapt. They don't record video information. They interpret the scene. They provide information on where people are located, in which direction they're looking in real time. Eventually, we'll get to the point where we have these smart light fixtures and luminaires that are talking to each other. Going down a hallway one direction, the lights behind you don't need to be on unless there's someone looking there. If you begin to turn, but before you do finish turning, maybe they do come back on. So we're looking at adaptive systems. We're working with the California Lighting Technology Center, who's probably the nation's foremost leader in lighting design research. Our goal is not to do the lighting design. We leave that to the experts, but is to develop the enabling technology that they can adapt. And they now have some of our initial prototypes in their laboratory. Unfortunately, I tried this earlier, and in the transfer of the file from Logan to here, I can't show you a couple of videos. But these two videos, the first one would have shown you a person walking into a room and a little vector arrow hanging off their nose, looking at it, and essentially it would follow the position of the person's eyes and direction where they were looking at. The other one showed three or four people walking into a room and sitting down in different locations, and in the upper right-hand corner, a little module would show how many people are in the room, where they're at, and a general idea of the direction they're looking. So what our group has shown is that we first have developed a better occupancy sensor. The occupancy sensors that most of us are aware of have the hand-waving problem, and they're based on IR technology. Our first-generation sensor essentially eliminates that, so you don't have a 15-minute delay between leaving the room and the lights going off. We've also demonstrated near real-time gaze estimation, and we've begun to install these technologies with some of our strategic partners. Talk a little bit about algae. A few years ago, there was a bit of a bubble in this area, I would say. A lot of euphoria over its potential. Personally, I still think it has a lot of future value for America. I mentioned the idea of placing it locations other than where you have fertile soil and rainfall. Why algae? Well, it's very productive. It's more productive. It has a simple cell structure. It captures carbon rapidly. It's capable of doubling mass several times a day. You can cultivate it on marginal or desert land. You can even cultivate it in ponds, embedded within ponds. You can use salt water, brackish water, wastewater, and some species have very high oil content. They also have a very high affinity for CO2. Turns out that some of the algal strains from the Great Salt Lake are some of the best oil producers, fast growers. In a competition with around 100 different strains for a DOD contract that was administered by General Atomics out of San Diego, three of the top four strains came from the Great Salt Lake and from one of the labs of one of my colleagues at USU, Dr. Lance Seafield. We have developed a USTAR-funded facility in Logan. This slide shows a picture of it. It has raceways, large and small. It now has a pond within a pond, algae growth systems. Inside the building, we have oil conversion systems. Essentially, we have an end-to-end process where we've gone from strains from the Great Salt Lake to liters of bio crude coming out the back end of this particular facility. This slide just shows sort of the flow process for algae from the organisms all the way to the co-products. It turns out that like any other fledgling energy technology, you have to look for every revenue stream that you possibly can, and co-products oftentimes are some of your best revenue streams. This slide essentially shows some of the progress we've made. We've set up a collaboratory. It's called the Great Salt Lake Collaboratory. It's been signed by 8 different organizations, primarily universities across the Mountain West. And Dr. Lance Seafield, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the leaders of that activity. We've also begun growing algae and produced water from the Uinta Basin, being able to remediate the water and produce algae at the same time. It turns out that in some cases we've achieved better growth in the produced water than from some of the lab media that we were using that we thought was optimized for growth. And we've demonstrated simultaneous lipid production and water remediation within the system. So we've developed these new cultivation techniques, we've scaled up a conversion process, and we've sent samples to a DOD customer. My looking at the future, I have a slide on this a little later. I still think algae has a lot of potential, not just potential, but it will become one of our biofuels over the next decade. This summer we will have a number of little demonstrations in the range of an acre or so that will demonstrate some of our cultivation techniques that we think will be cost effective. Turns out that in some of the earlier algal systems, the large costs were due to excavation, leveling the ground, and putting in liners and paddle wheels. And so with that in mind, we began looking at developing algal ponds within ponds that were growing the fast-growing strains of algae, using the water from below as a thermal leveler, so you could grow longer in the season for a supply of nutrients, and it's inherently level, so you don't have to do all of the extra excavation. And now I'm going to turn to a third area. I call it the future of electric vehicles, and the idea is to leapfrog the crowded and evolutionary field of battery research and lead revolutionary electrification pathway. The idea there is to circumvent the battery storage limitation, just essentially leapfrog it, electrify garages, parking lots, and major highways, use something called inductive power transfer for both stationary and moving vehicles, and eliminate the range anxiety. The key here is to fully leverage electricity's value propositions as an energy carrier. The grid's value propositions are its ability to move energy quickly and efficiently from point A to point B, take users out of the loop, and eliminate the need for on-site, or in this case, onboard storage. And let me draw a corollary back to electric lighting a century ago. Before the age of electric lighting, we lugged oil around, poured it into lamps, and lit lights that way. We had to manually deliver the energy to its point of use. We were involved in the process, and we required on-site storage. Electricity eliminated those three things. So until we fully leverage the value propositions of electricity and transportation, particularly surface transportation, I would argue that we will not transform surface transportation using electricity. But when we do, we will. The disruptive technology is this wireless power transfer, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but it requires magnetic coupling of fields from a transmitter to a receiver. Many of you may think, well, what about issues related to fields, safety issues? turns out a lot of work research has been done on that topic, and it's not only possible, but it has been achieved that that one can develop ways to minimize or even really keep it below norms, or not only norms, but lower limit standards. The Europeans have already actually began developing a standard for this for vehicles. We haven't done that yet here in the United States. Interestingly enough, just in the last 18 months, it has been demonstrated that you can have an air gap of up to a foot, which is essentially the same distance between a roadbed and the undercarriage of a vehicle, and you can have some lateral misalignments without any trouble. This slide actually is a little old. The transfer efficiency we've demonstrated in our laboratory is 80%. Our colleagues at the University of Auckland have demonstrated closer to 90% efficient transfer from over those distances. And a recent study was completed by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory that suggests that the only way to cost viability with electric vehicles is if we could offload part of that inner storage requirement. The batteries are the big weight and cost limiter there. The last thing I'm going to highlight is I mentioned earlier that if you're going to develop new technologies, in the case of unconventional fuels, out in the Uinta Basin, you have to get a baseline of the environmental impacts. And we have a study that we're doing under the auspices of the Eastern Utah Secure Energy Partnership and Program, where we're doing that, using laser-based technology to look at aerosols and other things of that nature and get a baseline ozone concentration measurement during the winter months. There are a host of sites across Eastern Utah where we're doing this study. And there's a lot more work that needs to be done, but I did want to highlight that as well. I'm going to move on now to just some predictions. When I asked the question, you know, what would you like to hear about, people said, well, Lisa mentioned that she thought you would like to hear my views. I think that liquid fuels derived from renewable and unconventional sources will be the bridge to electricity over the next few decades. We still have a need for those things, and we will for a long time. I would also say that anything you do electrically is probably going to be limited to surface transportation. We have barges that are going to still need fuel. We have airplanes that still need liquid fuels. The second thing I would say is that surface transportation will be transformed by electricity when its value propositions as an energy carrier are fully realized. I've already described that in some respects. The next is that wireless technology will enable a significant improvement in mobility of people and goods, just as it did the mobility of information in the recent decade. This goes beyond, I think, just energy. I think it goes to the automation of traffic flow. There's a partnership that we've created that includes a couple of universities. UC Berkeley is one. And their focus is not on the energy side of it, but on the automation side of traffic flow. How can we automate traffic flow? Turns out that the electricity may be an enabler for automation. It may provide some lane tracking opportunities. If I go back to the lighting analogy, a century ago we lit buildings. We moved electricity into buildings to light them. Think of all the things that we did with that electricity once that happened. New forms of entertainment, personal computing, refrigeration. The list goes on and on and on. Appliances, electric appliances. Could the same thing happen in transportation? I think that it probably can, and I think it probably will. The next prediction is, because of its inherent advantages, I still believe algae. I do believe algae energy systems will gain a foothold over the next decade. In buildings, manual, on-off, or binary, and reactive systems will give way to those that are automated, continually adjustable, and intuitive. The focus will go away from the components and into the systems level change. Although hidden behind the quest for better solar cells, and we've spent several billion dollars on solar cells here in the United States, use of electricity in buildings will continue as our most valuable and cost-effective use of solar energy, that is, sunlight in its natural form. A few years ago, I did a calculation on the energy saved in Walmarts using skylights and compared it to the amount of electricity we were generating with solar energy through solar cells. It might be interesting to note that my calculation suggested that Walmart was saving more energy in their 4,500 stores scattered across the United States and the globe than we were generating with all the solar cells that we had produced. I don't know if that's still true or not. That's been 3 or 4 years ago, and we've done a lot of work and made a lot of progress on solar cells. But again, analyzing the system from a different level, I think, can help. I think the last prediction, I think, is that increasingly outsiders to the federal system, that is, universities and small businesses, will be the providers of these game-changing energy innovations. And let me just look through my slides here, my paper here. These universities and small businesses are less expensive. They're less constrained by their government owners. They're marked by a steady flow of fresh faces, particularly at universities, with new ideas that are undeterred by the impediments of the past. Young people offer new perspectives and are more willing to take the risks to champion new out-of-the-box ideas that challenge the status quo. Universities and businesses lack the organizational and process structures and resources necessary to facilitate and incubate these big ideas, or the interdisciplinary teaming required oftentimes to cultivate them. You could say they're idea-rich and cash-poor. Because of the evolutionary nature of organizational change and the self-preservation mechanisms, the current federal energy R&D business model has evolved over time to favor government laboratories. It's unlikely that the playing field will be leveled until change to underlying process structures emerge from internal realignments or from outside pressure. Today's pipeline of innovators and innovation is significantly smaller than if universities and small businesses had been more integrally involved in the federal energy innovation ecosystem over the past half century. This is one of the fundamental reasons why America finds itself at the energy impasse that we're in today, I would say. And it comes at a time when competition for top talent with new global competitors like China and India is growing. Energy is the most intractable and important challenge facing America that could be addressed by harnessing the brain power and curiosity of universities and the risk-taking profit motive prowess of small businesses. Times are changing. Universities and small businesses are bypassing the federal system and garnering state and private funds to begin innovating and creating green-collar jobs. The state of Utah's USTAR program is a great example of that. Had it not been for USTAR, EDL, the Energy Dynamics Laboratory, likely wouldn't exist, and I certainly wouldn't be standing here tonight. Thanks to many, Utah's is also on solid financial footing, unlike many of our neighboring states. It also has a governor who recognizes and has given priority to the need for energy innovation driven by an educated workforce. And speaking of workforce, Utah has a young, talented pool of professionals eager to make a difference. I would probably say that that's the thing that I like most about where I work today. I highlighted a few of those individuals earlier. To take the next step and put Utah on the map, I would suggest that we need to host a few large-scale public-private leading-edge energy demonstrations based on some of these innovations. You might call this the Utah Leads Initiative, Leading Edge Energy Demonstration Program, something to balance or interact with the USTAR program. Other states have already done this by leveraging modest state investments. A 20% cost share is typically required, and they've garnered some significant federal funds. For example, a few years ago, Tennessee attracted over $100 million, or I should say exactly $100 million, in federal funding for a massive plug-in hybrid demonstration program, thousands of vehicles or so, in a number of plug-in stations scattered across a couple of the metropolitan areas. It's no surprise that Nissan announced a few weeks ago that they'd be building a large plant in Tennessee to serve this emerging electric vehicle market. Here in Utah, others are already working on large-scale demonstrations. Colleagues at the University of Utah are working on a large-scale carbon sequestration program. Some of the individuals involved in that program are here tonight. I'd like to think we could follow that up with a few other big projects that responsibly develop our unique resources and demonstrate some of these transformational energy systems. I think the key there is to think ahead, put together a modest pool of funds, and then compete successfully. In conclusion, our ability to and freedom to innovate in the energy sector is being starved by a federal innovation ecosystem that eats our seed corn and perpetuates big government and the status quo. By refocusing on the development of enabling technologies that lead to transformational energy systems and a new R&D business model that better engages research universities, affiliated research centers associated with them, and small businesses and other businesses, America can fill these innovation gaps in the federal energy R&D portfolio, provide dramatic benefits, I believe, to the nation, and train the next generation to, in the words of President Obama, win the future. More important to our discussion here tonight, Utah can lead the way if people like you are educated, continue to be engaged, and help along the way. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jeff. Before we move on to the question and answer session, I want to briefly take a moment to thank our audience listening on KCBW Public Radio 88.3 and 105.3 FM. We will have a couple of microphones going up each side of the auditorium. We welcome your questions, but please speak into the microphone so that the radio audience can hear. So, questions.
This is a very interesting talk. I'm in the biomedical field. Our interactions with government agencies are with the NIH, extramural research model, which seems to operate a lot more efficiently than the national labs. I've never been really impressed with DOE. Do you think you could convert the DOE over to that model? And what part of the large-scale integration, how do you envision that being handled? Because the extramural research doesn't do that.
That's a good point. I think there are big projects, big science projects. For example, in the area of neutron science, the spallation neutron source at a national laboratory, it makes a lot of sense to have a dedicated facility, dedicated staff. Can we convert the federal government to a different model? Particularly, I should say, your question was the Department of Energy. I think it'll take a while. If you look at the committees, for example, in Congress, that authorize and appropriate funds, over the last two decades, I think there's been less than two or three years, maybe just 1 year, where either the ranking member or the chairman weren't from a national lab state. If you look at those committees, they're almost all populated by congressional delegations from those states. So that's, from the congressional side, it'll be a tough battle. In terms of the administration itself, I think it's probably doable. I think that program managers in the federal system would be willing, but it's a long slog to do that. The institutional inertia is not sort of on the side of a new model. Regarding integration in big projects, I think big projects in the case of energy demonstrations, et cetera, should be led by industry. Large system integrators, et cetera, I think can do a pretty good job doing that. I guess so that would be my answers to those two questions. I'm not sure your microphone's on.
On now? Yeah. One quick follow-up. For the big projects, I don't have a problem with industry leading, but the problem is the capital. The capital investment.
Oh. Yeah, obviously.
Industry isn't going to take that on.
Yeah, obviously, I'm talking of risky projects that may be dominantly funded by the federal government, maybe with a small cost share, but I would argue that to actually do the projects, manage them, and so forth, if it's beyond basic and long-term applied research, then it could be translated straight to industry with contributions for other organizations. But again, with federal involvement with financing.
Professor Moose, at the beginning of your address, you noted that we don't have national energy goals, and you talked about the space program and the interstate highway construction programs as coherent, large-scale federal initiatives. Poll after poll seems to show that the public in general supports transforming our energy system and doing things with carbon dioxide emissions reduction, that sort of thing. But it seems to me that the center of the problem and the primary impediment is in fact the Congress, and most particularly the United States Senate with its filibuster rules. You've been an advisor to the Senate. How are we going to get a coherent energy program out of a deadlocked Congress and a deadlocked Senate?
That's a tough question. Let me start by saying something that could be, it's certainly probably not widely viewed at this point, but I do believe that the federal government, as I mentioned, can do things whenever it's largely a federal program. I would venture to say that electrifying our highway system is something that is actionable, at least partially, by the federal government. And that's unlike a more broadly termed goal of saying we're going to get 80% of our electricity from renewable sources. The only thing that the federal government can do in that case is incentivize, provide loan guarantees, and so forth. They can't do it themselves. In the case of these other things, as I mentioned, they can, and I would argue that there may be one or two opportunities, particularly the one I just mentioned, that the federal government and state governments could have a say in. To the larger question of the Senate, I'll go back to what I said is I think that two things. One is is as long as we can maintain our flexibility, freedom, and control, and those of the American people, and we can have ideas, or we can create ideas, like I mentioned before, my former boss said, we have a lot of tacticians, but very few ideas. If we can generate ideas that maintain that flexibility, freedom, and control, and still transform the energy system, I think that even the Senate will fall in line. They've demonstrated, at least in my time there, that mandates weren't something that they were too interested in pursuing. And so long as the goal is, so long as the interest is in innovation as opposed to mandates, then we have to find solutions that do those things that I just mentioned. If we do that, I would argue that even the politicians in Washington would fall in line.
I've been recently encouraged by some work by a Dr. Nocera at MIT in splitting water and using the hydrogen available from that because of its abundance. He says that that's the only source that is large enough to feed the world's needs for energy going into the future. Yet I didn't hear any discussion of that tonight.
Good point. I'm familiar with his work, and I certainly applaud his activities. In terms of our sources of energy, I believe that we need all the different sorts available, and I'm not going to go into detail there. I do think in the case of electrifying our transportation system, there's a couple studies done that suggest that a large portion of our spinning reserve could be converted into storage systems on board vehicles if there's enough interplay between the grid and the vehicles themselves to take that up. In terms of our sources, I think obviously the long-term solution, solar, whether it be through hydrogen, whether it be through photoelectric conversion, et cetera. And so I do think that a continued emphasis on that is relevant and warranted. In terms of a hydrogen economy, I do think that ultimately electricity will be the carrier of choice for most of our energy systems, as opposed to hydrogen as a storage medium that's moved from point A to point B. So I think as an intermediary, there's great opportunities and lots of promise for work done at MIT and other places. I think that a continued investment in that's warranted. I think as an energy carrier that the electricity is likely to be less challenging. I don't know if that answered your question properly or not, but another question?
I think this will be a little bit simpler. You're being sponsored by the Utah Museum of Natural History. They're building a new building. Are we going to see some of the things that you talked about today up at the new facility? Will we see skylights? Will we see light systems going on and off? And a second question here about the algae. Do you see it as a fuel for cars? Do you see it as sequestering carbon? What do you think are algae's real uses?
Okay, I can't answer the question about the museum. I'd be happy to have someone. Sarah, you want to address that?
I'll give you a quick answer. We're not using biofuels, although what a great idea. It is a LEED Gold building. We have skylights. We have the automated light systems, highly energy efficient, even though museums are by their nature not energy efficient, but we're working very hard to do that, and we're also planning to put solar on the roof. We're working with the state to develop a power purchase agreement. So there are lots of things that are pertinent to tonight's talk that you'll see in a year.
Thank you. To the second question that you had relative to algae, I think it's both. It's as I mentioned earlier, I think it's a transition fuel to electricity over the next two or three decades. It's one of the different options for that. And in terms of carbon recycling,
certainly. I think it has a lot of potential, particularly from central emitters, where you can use the flue gas, for example, to both mix the algae, help keep it algae suspended, and at the same time enhance growth because of the affinity for some strains for CO2 or carbon.
This question is in relation to that. There's a, I think you pronounce his last name Ventner. He's the man who did the human genome. He's a genetic modification person. He's under the, as I understand it, under the impression that no natural algae is going to be able to do this, and it's going to come out of a test tube. Is that accurate, or is that just his opinion because he's a GM kind of guy?
Well, I would argue that I don't necessarily think that we need to do that. I think that there can be strain optimization, strain migration, migration of natural strains to improve their performance. For example, one of the researchers at USU, I mentioned Dr. Seafeld, and some of his students have done a lot of work on strain optimization and strain migration, and the idea there is to migrate some of the strains to grow better in higher or lower temperatures, higher temperatures, doing things like crop rotation like we do with land-based plants, things of that nature. But at the same time, I would sort of counter my initial response by saying that the same chemistry, biology, and so forth that improved dramatically the yield of terrestrial crops could do the same with algae systems. There's there's a plethora of species and strains, and our knowledge of those is very minimal in comparison to a lot of other things.
You talked about the risk quite a bit. You said that the status quo, the federal government and things like that, it's a little bit, they prefer incremental change. They're averse to risk. But you also talked about unconventional sources of oil. It seems like there are some huge risks associated with that. What do you think that those risks are? And could you be convinced that they're indeed too great? And if so, what would convince you?
There are risks. I think water, air quality are good examples. Will there be issues related to contamination of water supplies, fresh water supplies, for example? One of the slides that I showed was basically an air monitoring baseline of the Uinta Basin. The idea there is to understand, get a baseline of where we're at before unconventional fuels are started there. In Canada, Alberta, there's been a lot of unconventional fuel development. I think that as we speak, a lot of folks from the United States are going up there and benchmarking that process to look at air and water quality issues, for example. Another way I would just say is efficiency, how efficient is the process. A lot of high temperature processes are required in many cases. Thermal energy has to come from somewhere. And so I would say that right now that in terms of the federal government and their investments in unconventional is primarily around understanding rather than actually doing, primarily in the United States. So I think there are issues that we're in a process of baselining now, and also there's a group of people that are benchmarking activities in Canada.
Yes, first I'd like to applaud you just on the broad-based approach. Like, it's really fantastic to see a lab out there doing such a broad-scale approach, and also the fact that you've landed on electrification is the final result that we'll get there. But I wanted to ask you, when you look at the situation with peak oil and a lot of what we have right now about the information about where we're at with the supply of oil, the time scale of incremental change to sometime eventually getting to renewable isn't realistic, and we're not on a time scale of decades. And the risk that we face is the United States, because of our disproportionate reliance on foreign oil, or that we're at a huge risk that we're not going to make that transition. And that because of that risk, that we're waiting from leadership from a top-down perspective. And while the United States is at a huge wealth advantage, both in the amount of money that we have compared to anyone else in the world from a citizen demand perspective and how much we spend, but also from natural resources and the fact that we're being completely outcompeted by countries like Germany and Japan, who have far less resources in total, and that we're all looking from a top-down federal perspective, when in reality, a true renewable distributed grid, the federal government, because of their current relationship to the existing power structure, will never ever truly get behind that, because it means the dissolution of the energy structure as it is. And that in fact, what we need is a real leadership at a local base of incentivizing citizens of a state like Utah, that we have the ability and the wealth here to transform our local community. If people were really aware of the real risks and what we're facing right now, that we could transform this community, as you said, and be a leader to other communities from the inside out, instead of looking from federal leadership from the top down?
Couldn't have said it better. yeah, I mentioned, you know, some of our initial, the challenges up front, and the fact that we're sort of, that there's a lot of, you know, sort of bypassing the federal government. You know, I spoke primarily about the innovation side as opposed to some of the things that I think that you're alluding to. And I remember I was sitting in a room with a marketing guru several years ago, and I said the biggest problem we had in America was we didn't have a, you know, set of national energy goals, like one of our other questioners mentioned. And she looked at me and said, it's the people and willingness to change and things of that nature that are more the issue than the federal government. And so I think there's a balance between the two, and but I do think that you're right that we can't wait. USTAR isn't waiting, for example, here in the state. Certainly our governor isn't waiting for, and unless he has to because of certain, you know, mandates and things of that nature. And I do think that, as one of the other questioners, that we are headed in the long term towards a renewable system. I do think that the carrier will be electricity in most cases. And I agree that, you know, that we have to engage locally. And frankly, the opportunity to speak tonight was my first opportunity to do something like this. And it's the first time that I've chose to go beyond just talking about the projects that I've worked on and look at the system at a much broader from a broader perspective.
Hello? Yeah, there's a lot of talk about this person that you know, is innovative and so forth. Where would that person find a place to find other people who have that common goal? If I were to ask you the question, where would I, are there five people in the state of Utah that seriously want to solve this problem? What if that person spent, 10 years, had the master's degrees from engineering, and what if they actually had a solution that could get 90% of the fuel out of this country with motive, buildings, and other things? Where would that person hang out at a cafeteria? Where do you network to find people who seriously want to solve this problem? That this hypothetical person, I know him kind of well, but
right.
where do you actually
I
find it? Because
that.
I don't, yeah. I can't snuggle up to your laboratories.
Yeah.
And there is definitely a wall between the average guy. Literally, I'm working in my garage, by the way.
Well,
where do you actually find people who are done? This is going to be a private sector thing.
Yeah.
So where do the, should we set up a cafeteria in the library here and say, hey, we meet on Wednesday or what?
Well, I know one place that you can go, at least within the state, and I'm not sure that it should be, as mentioned earlier, a top-down perspective, but there's a technology outreach program within the USTAR activity, and I know that they field people questions or people with ideas and energy that they want to develop and help along the way. There's a coordinator down in the south. There's a coordinator here. There's one in the basin. There's one up north. That's one place. And then to the other question is, I think that at the state level, there's the convening authority at the state level. Again, I'm talking on the top side, top down perspective. Is the governor, and I know that he's interested in energy. He's talked about it a lot. And I think he has a task force who's developed a number of recommendations and issued a report as well. So from bottom up, I would say that USTARS is probably as good as anywhere to start. And from the top down, I think the governor has the convening authority and is beginning to exercise it. Governor's Office of Economic.
I've called the governor's office before, and Mike Sullivan, and I've spoken to him an hour and a half on the phone. And after I explained to him that I believe I can get 90% of the fuel out of this country, he told me that interest in Brno and price are not interested in such technology. And I think that the average person would like to have that technology in their home. And this technology can be in your car, can be in your house, and it can get an average person about $5,000 net income every year out of Vermont, and it has about a 15 cap rate. So I talked to the governor, I talked to 27 different state representatives, and not one of them were interested. Not one.
I think that you just got a card from someone who works from the. Yeah, I don't have an answer other than the ones that I mentioned earlier.
Noticing that everyone's leaving, I think it's because we're doomed ultimately. I mean, there's no doubt about the ice samples that are taken, and it shows that we're going down. I mean, what are you gonna do about it? There's nothing really to do but come here and talk, right?
Relative to the issue of carbon, I guess I didn't dwell on it a lot tonight. What I would say is that if we can improve our efficiency, for example, the lighting technology that I mentioned, if we can, rather than a 5% improvement in a lighting technology, if we can cut lighting use without deterring our flexibility, freedom, and controls by, say, 50%, that would be, equivalent to taking several power plants out of our system. So. What I would say is I'm motivated to improve efficiency and production of carbon as a result of that is what I am glad and happy to see happen as well, and I think it's important. Like I said, I didn't get into carbon directly, and I didn't want to open up a long discussion here tonight.
You don't have a lot of time, I understand. But can I ask one question about neutrinos and algae? Is Salt Lake, if we're, sitting on a well of energy with algae, have neutrinos ever been brought into that discussion?
I'd have to ask a couple of my colleagues about the level of engagement in that. I don't have an answer for you there.
Okay.
I have a business here in Murray that converts cars to run on electricity, plug-in electricity. And I have a vested interest in what you're talking about when you talk about inductive pickup. But I heard this almost same lecture last summer. And at that time, the speaker discussed what they're doing in several projects in Korea. And there was another project in Genoa, Italy. And these are things that were actually taking place. And what I'd like to know is, due to the critical nature of our energy situation, a lot of people think it's critical, I do. I'd like to know, what have we done in the United States to do that? Are we going to let those foreign countries take that business away from us? That's part of my question.
That's a good question. The Koreans have invested about $50 million so far over the last 2 years in a wireless power transfer. Other than our research and a little bit at one of the national laboratories that's just beginning, which, you know, is more than an order of magnitude lower, that's about all that I'm aware of that's happening in the United States. And of course, the New Zealand research group has also invested considerably more than U.S. And so the answer to your question is, we are falling behind in this particular area, and we will likely go the same way as we did with some of the earlier technologies that I mentioned, unless we do, you know, begin a heavier investment.
So they plowed $50 million into something and we still haven't made much progress. Second part of my question is, how many plug-in electric vehicles does the state own, and how many are on the Utah State University campus?
Just to make the $50 million hasn't been expended in the United States. It's been expended in Korea, and they have demonstrations of a bus system that when it parks at different locations on a route is powered wirelessly. In terms of plug-in hybrid vehicles at the state, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that USU has installed or is in the process of installing a few plug-in stations on campus. In terms of the number of hybrid or plug-in hybrid vehicles, I'd have to ask somebody else that question.
Well, it seems like there's lots of jawboning going on and not very much real action. So that's my thoughts.
All right, two more questions.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for your time. I don't want to get a debate going on carbon credits and cap and trade, but I'm wondering if maybe that's what a lot of people are puzzled about right now. In terms of why aren't things moving forward, do you think, and what are your views, what are your company's views, stance on the future of, I'm kind of waking up to a lot of what today's problems are with energy, and it seems to me like everyone's kind of sitting on the sidelines in terms of the federal government and even private sector money, waiting to see what is going to happen with this cap and trade and carbon credits, because it's pretty much going to dictate the importance of how fast and how quickly and how much money everyone can make and how many jobs we can stimulate. If you could respond on that, even though
okay. I certainly can't speak for the university on its stance on carbon credits, cap and trade, those sorts of things. And our focus is on energy innovations as opposed to policy activities and decisions that may or may not occur. So I hate to defer the question, but as an organization, we don't have a particular stance on carbon credits or things of that nature.
comment I would have is that I think a lot of the problems could be solved with one very dirty word, and that's probably fuel taxes or carbon taxes. And I think that a large part of the problem that happened with the automobile industry was caused by the fact that they tried to have these CAFE standards dictate things instead of just having a cost of fuel. If they'd had a cost on fuel, we would have long ago had cars that people desired that would get better economy. And the other thing, I agree a lot with what you said on the where, you know, things are going to get powered by electricity, and there's a big problem with where we're going to get our electricity from. I think a lot of people don't know where a lot of the new electricity generation is coming from. It's coming from natural gas. Mm-hmm. I might think that instead of algae, that natural gas will probably play more of a bridge role in the nearer term.
Yeah, I would say that, in terms of surface transportation, I think liquid fuels are going to be a part of the bridge. Natural gas-powered vehicles, certainly if you talk to T. Boone Pickens, he believes that it has a large potential there. I think that that's probably a good statement. I mean, I would agree that there's a role for natural gas in surface transportation in vehicles, and certainly in electric generation. As you say, a large percentage of the new capacity is in the form of natural gas, which is generally a little cleaner than coal, and so. I would agree with your assessment there.
I mean, I think longer term, I can't see any solution other than building more nuclear plants. I know a lot of people are afraid of them, but I don't see that there's any other longer term solution. I don't think we'll ever get more than a few percent of our energy out of wind. Solar, somebody I think was from MIT and was on NPR, the other day was saying if we wanted to go with solar, we would have to cover every roof in America with solar cells. And he was doing this in response to Obama's desire to get us on a clean energy footing by, I think it was 2035, which sounds like a long ways in the future. He said to do that, if we wanted to build nuclear plants, we'd have to be building one a week. I think he's a little bit overstated. I think his size of his plants were a little bit wrong on that, but I mean, it just goes to show where the problems are. I mean, it's a huge problem. Probably the easiest thing to do is efficiency, as you said.
Yeah. Well, thanks for those comments. I would agree that the issue with solar, you mentioned you'd have to cover a lot of space, is energy density, the amount of energy per square meter of sunlight. And I suppose there's an argument to be made that we've used sources that emit their effluent into the air for quite a while, and maybe there's a larger role for those types of technologies that don't emit carbon into the atmosphere and/or other pollutants. Thank you very much for your time.